Welcome to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast, where top football coaches from around the country share their stories, philosophies, concepts, and strategies to help you get better on and off the field. Now, here's your host, Keith Grabowski.
Welcome to the Coach and Coordinator Podcast. Today, we're going to be focusing on the topic, why kids don't play football anymore. And there's certainly a lot of things we read in the media. I know as coaches, we get frustrated with that at times. We hear different reports, some without all the facts in them, some media headlines that are certainly attention-grabbing. And I think we focus on those things and maybe blame the health and safety factor of the game that gets attacked. But in some ways, I've always believed that's a little bit of a red herring. I think with all youth sports, it is about the experience. And if a kid's going to love the game, he's going to continue playing. So joining me today on the podcast is a coach who wrote an article about this, and you'll be able to see it on blogs.usafootball.com by the time this podcast airs. And that's Jay Stolfi. Jay, thanks for joining me here.
Thanks, Keith.
Jay, so our listeners know, tell us a little bit about your background in coaching.
Well, I coach in Connecticut. I started off as a youth coach, as a dad, you know, like a lot of coaches did. Came up through the system all the way from flag football through high school football. Got about 13, 14 years of on-field coaching experience. A lot of that time was junior high school level football, 7th and 8th graders, for a travel league here in Connecticut. And the last several years at the high school level where I was a JV coach and an offensive coordinator. I'm currently working for a prep school, handling all their stats and video and technology packages. I've done some writing, have my own offensive system, been a Nike Coach of the Year lecturer around the country, and just enjoy general thinking and tinkering with the sport of football.
And Coach, you and I had this conversation about a week ago, and I said, you know, we should have just hit record at that time because those are all the things we're going to talk about today. But in this article, you start with an interesting quote, and I think this is when I opened this article and read it for the first time, it's really got my attention. It's, I have met the enemy and he is us. Tell me how that kind of encapsulates the article and kind of our topic today.
Well, as you open the program with, certainly there's safety concussion issues, but I think there's a greater underlying problem that is affecting why we're losing kids at youth and high school football. And I think that problem has to do with what I call a poor football experience that comes from poor coaching or poor administration of football programs. And it's a solvable problem, but it's a self-inflicted problem. And, you know, unlike the concussions and the medical issues and a lot of the stuff that came out into the press and eventually the general public with the high-profile injuries from some of the, you know, Hernandez and Junior Seau, the problem that we face, I believe, with this poor coaching, poor football experience, the good news is that it's solvable. You know, the problem is us, but the solution also is us. And as depressing as it is to lose kids to football, it's at least within our grasp to fix the problem and get those kids back into the fold.
And I know that's something we don't like to hear in the coaching profession, that, you know, some of this is on us. But when I look at just, you know, games I go out to, I leave kind of scratching my head at times. And you had this very topic kind of in the introduction of your article. You see a team out there. This is youth. This is high school, middle school. I would venture to say you could even go into some of the small college level and see some things. But you see a team out there with some decent athletes, and they're running and doing things, they're running systems that just don't mesh very well. For example, I saw a team this season that ended up being 1-9 on the season. They weren't in very many games. I was working the chains in this particular game, and I'm watching these kids come off the field and thinking, man, that kid should be getting the ball. He's a good-looking athlete. Man, he can run well. He carries his pads well. He's built. And he's not getting the ball. They're in a system which was quarterback-driven, They never put anybody in the backfield other than the quarterback that game. They're trying to run screens. They're trying to run quick passes. They're trying to run stuff down the field. And ultimately, everything fell on this kid who I felt wasn't quite ready for that kind of a role. Maybe he will be down the line. But at that particular time, the team wasn't well served to be in that offense. And I know we get caught up in all the different things that we see on TV or are popular or trendy, but ultimately we have to build around the players we have. And you kind of have a similar experience.
The article that you referenced that I wrote leads off with a similar example where I'm at a prep school, a New England prep school high school football game. And I'm watching the game, and one side clearly is dominating the other side. And it's almost uncomfortable watching the game. And almost exactly what you described, it wasn't that there were no good athletes on the losing team. It's that the athletes that they had weren't put in positions to be successful. The kids that were, you know, mediocre athletes weren't put in positions to be successful. And even though the losing team probably wouldn't have beaten the better team, even with some good coaching, the greater point is that the team that was losing lost badly. And it wasn't merely a talent disparity. It was poor coaching, poor planning. And those the team lost 47-0. They didn't make a single first down. The winning team put their second string in fairly early, and even they dominated. And by the time the third string came in for the winning team in the end of the game, you know, I think the other team finally got a first down. And as a coach, as a parent, I've been on the administration side of sports leagues. It was painful to see. And the parents of that team, of the losing team, were making all kinds of excuses about how the coach is a great guy. He really knows his stuff because he used to coach, you know, college football. That's great, but he's a lousy high school coach. And he's a lousy high school coach because whatever experience he has, whatever knowledge he has, isn't getting translated to those kids. The kids aren't benefiting from that knowledge. And you learn a little bit later that their program's been kind of going downhill for the past few years. They went 0 for the season this year. I think they went 0 for the season last year. And it won't be long before you hear that this school may not be offering a football program. And that's what I was talking about earlier. I think it's entirely within our power as coaches and administrators to not have that happen.
Well, definitely. And I think part of it is we have to make sure we're putting our players in a position of success. That's number one. But also, you know, we have to give them a positive experience. We need to think about, you know, the player-coach relationship as well. And that head coach and the assistants need to have not just those people skills, because the relationship is important, but ultimately, you know, their strategy is involved in the game. I know a lot of guys will talk about culture eats strategy, and talk to actually a great coach on our podcast, Andrew Coverdale, who's 12-time state champion at Louisville Trinity in Kentucky, and he says it doesn't need to be a dichotomy. And I think we've swung that way where, you know, we do consider it that way. Then we think we could build a culture and everything's going to be good. Well, you know, ultimately, all those great things we might do all off season long, all through camp, could easily fall apart once we hit competition because we didn't fully think that through and put the kids in a position to be successful on the field, meaning that we didn't think about their skill sets that they have, the ones that we developed, and had an honest, you know, conversation about how well is this really going to work for us.
Yeah, and I think the key word there, Keith, is honest. And that's what I think is lacking. And I, you know, it doesn't mean the opposite of that is dishonest. I guess realistic unrealistic is probably a better term. But
yeah.
When I first started coaching, you know, I probably wasn't the best coach. But I'll tell you what I did well is I listened. And I was fairly realistic and, you know, willing to learn and make changes as the season went on and from season to season. And I think at some point, coaches get comfortable and complacent with what they know and time the rest of the world is changing around them. So what I outline in the article, and I bring up some statistics to kind of back up the point, is that the world is changing a bit. And our kids, whether it's a 10-year-old youth player or a 16-year-old high school player, they're living in a different world than what you and I grew up in and what a lot of these coaches grew up in. in that they live in this digital instant society. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those are the kids, actually, I think, that would benefit the most from being in a football program, from learning how to wait their turn, become a starter eventually, learning how to be part of a team, learning when you're the star, when you're the bench player. You know, you really want those kids in your program. But if you're doing things the same way that your coach did when you were a kid, it's too big of a leap for these kids who are used to having things instantly to be able to spend hours and hours and hours of time in practice. If they're not kept busy, if they're not kept interested, if it's, you know, what I see a lot, what we talked about last time is, you know, a handful of coaches giving all their attention to a handful of players, while a lot of the non-star players are literally taking a knee in the hot sun for the whole month of August while the stars get their attention, the likelihood of bringing those kids back gets smaller and smaller as each year passes. And again, the reason for writing that article is I think that's the driver of the loss of players, not necessarily the safety-related issues, but again, the silver lining is that that kind of stuff is clearly within our control, where each and every program, if they're alerted to this and they're a little more aware, can start bringing kids back and start monitoring the coaching and the practices and everything to make sure that it's a worthwhile product for, you know, for the kids year after year.
Well, I'll agree with that 100%. We definitely live in a different time now, and I think growing up in the 70s and 80s, probably started playing youth football around 1980 or so when I was 10. There honestly wasn't much more. I mean, we had three channels on TV, and we rode our bikes around, and we played, you know, whatever sport it was. We didn't have personal trainers. We didn't have performance centers. We went up to the park, and we played and kind of looked forward to the time when we could do it in a formal way. And I remember, honestly, my first football experience, I think about it, it was when I was nine. And my dad was a high school football coach, took me out to practice. I mean, I was so looking forward to it. I was a kid. I'd wear my helmet, you know, football helmet that my dad got me around the house all day long. I mean, football was my thing. And I get out there, go through the first few practices, and I didn't want to play. You know, there was nothing that was good about it to me. It was like guys yelling, and, you know, there was actually not very much football going on because all they were doing was conditioning us. And it wasn't the right time. My dad actually pulled me out of it. I went back to it the next year and played till I couldn't play anymore, played till my knee said no, and then began coaching the game. So, I mean, I had a passion for it, and I was able to survive, I guess, that bad experience. But most kids today, they're just not going to do it. And honestly, their parents will support them not doing it. There's too many things. They want their kids to be happy. You know, part of it, I guess, maybe is on us as parents. They don't like to see their kids suffer if they think you're suffering, and so they look for something else and go a different way. But I think we're missing out a lot on some of the things that the game teaches as well, that you can't get from playing video games or maybe doing some other activities or whatever it might be. There's still all those things. You know, when you talk to coaches, I mean, ultimately, that's why they coach the game, that it teaches so much. That I guess we got to look at how can we still be able to get these kids to play the game and realize that it's going to take some work, and at the same time balance that they're on-demand type of kids in society right now.
In my article, I say a lot of that, and I actually bring it in a little more. I think, and you know, you can, if your experience is different than mine, let me know. I think a lot of boys still want to play football. I mean, they kind of naturally, without knowing about the yelling, without thinking too hard about it, which, you know, yeah, I have two teenage boys, and believe me, they're thinking ahead is not their strong point. But I think boys just kind of like football. It just naturally. So we have that going for us. And it is, in my opinion, the best example, the team sport that is most likely to teach strong life lessons. With the, you know, it's the most team-oriented sport. It's not a sport that, like basketball or baseball, which I loved and I've coached before, but a dominant point guard or a dominant pitcher can really kind of take over a game, and the other players are a little less involved. But in football, there's, you know, 22 players on the field, and the teamwork that's needed and the specializations of positions, and you need punters and middle linebackers and long snappers and quarterbacks is, you know, kind of almost a spot for every kid to find some role on the team. And I think a lot of people might misunderstand my intentions that I'm perhaps bashing football. It's quite the opposite. I think that those kids that we described earlier that maybe play too much Xbox, or their parents probably pave the path a little bit too much for them instead of preparing the kids for the path and be able to handle some bumps, those are exactly the kids that we need to get into football and keep into football so that they can go through and learn all these life lessons. We just have never bridged the gap. When I say we, there are some programs out there that are doing a fabulous job of you know, maintaining kids year after year, and their numbers are good. But an awful lot, and a growing number of programs, just haven't bridged that gap yet of offering a program that is fast-paced, that respects the kids' time, and keeps kids engaged year after year. I'm not saying that you have to win every game all the time, but you have to offer the kids an expectation of winning each season. You have to offer them the expectation of competing for a spot. You have to offer them the expectation of fast-paced, moving, always doing something. You know, boys like to move. I reference a scholarly journal in the article that compares boys to girls and how much different boys are in their need for physical activity. And football is one of the last remaining sports where young boys, teenage boys, are encouraged to get out there and be physical. And that's exactly what a lot of these kids need today.
You know, I've been in the situation as a head high school coach where I wanted to help my programs all the way down. In fact, we started a youth football program at the one place, didn't have it. And, I mean, it took off. But what was important to me was that we were teaching them in a progression and allowing them to learn our systems but not forcing them into our systems. I actually read an article that was in Sports Illustrated that talked about, I forget where he was, but a 25-year-old head coach who has, you know, every team in his program running an up-tempo spread huddle. And I think in some places you might be able to pull that off, probably where you have a little bit bigger pool to choose from. But I think in most places, you have to, as that high school coach, think about things in terms of a progression. And I love, for example, to run the stretch play. And, I mean, we had some athletes, and we would have to, you know, the reach block and having to get out to the edge and maybe even block as people started adjusting to what we're doing, a wide nine, and then learn how to adjust to that. And, you know, that becomes very complex to try to translate that, not just for those young players, but also for those coaches who are honestly giving their time. And I applaud anybody who volunteers to be a youth football coach. But I also understand, like, we got to be realistic what we have those guys coach as well. So it's more about really getting maybe deeper into the fundamentals and teaching those guys how to practice. I think the worst thing you can do with a young kid today is send him to any sport practice and put him in a long line and have him take, you know, minutes between reps. You got to find ways to better structure practice, to work with partners, to games, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah, and when he gets to the front of that long line and he finally gets his turn after minutes, then you give him some task like making a reach block on a wide nine, you know, defensive end, and it's difficult or he doesn't understand it. Now he goes back to the end of that long line for the next several minutes. That's not a fun experience, and it didn't help the team.
No, that's exactly it. I took a few years back. My son was, you know, playing youth football, and I helped out the team, and it was funny because – in a lot of ways, you know, guys looked at me like, oh, you're a college football coach. Yeah, that might work where you guys, but we do it this way here. And I thought, well, I'm a coach. I study this. I do this for a living. This is my profession. But I, you know, I went along with it. I wasn't there to rock the boat. I was there to do the best I could. But, you know, we had, I want to say, like 8 dad volunteers, and we still worked in these long lines of drills with that exact format. And I'm thinking we have a 4-to-1 player to coach ratio, and we're turning this into a, you know, 25-to-1 player to coach ratio by the way we're running practice.
And that helps nobody. It's not good football. I mean, you know, let's forget about the altruistic good for the kids stuff. It's just not good football to not maximize reps, maximize your talent, do all that stuff. Here's a real life example, because think my number one point would be the biggest deficit in the football world today, and I'm talking youth and high school football, is lack of qualified coaches. Experienced coaches, there's a lot of, but experienced, qualified, with all the things that we're talking about, I think that's where the gap is. So here's a real-life example. What really got me into coaching was a nearby town here in Connecticut had a newly formed travel league, and they did a good job of raising money. You know, they, the parents, the boosters, the people who formed the league, the dreams were, you could tell where their efforts were, because they raised a lot of money and they raised a lot of awareness in the surrounding towns, and they spent a lot of their money on these excellent uniforms that looked just like the high school uniform, and they were able to secure a beautiful turf field as their home field and their practice field, and they did a lot of that. They now know to be, or what seemed to be, kind of superficial stuff. What they didn't do well is get good coaches. They just somehow, the raising the money and getting the uniforms and, you know, buying the helmets and printing the brochures was the focus of their getting the program going. So, not surprisingly, you know, the upper level team, most of the teams, but the team that I was most involved with, eventually the seventh, eighth grade team, went 0 for the first season. So, I mean, you know, you don't never have a lot of high expectations your first year as a new program. But when I say they went 0 for the season, I don't mean 0 for wins. I mean 0 for touchdowns. And I believe 0 for first downs. I don't know if they made a first down or a touchdown till their maybe the last game in an 8 or 10 game season. So they eventually figured out that they needed some coaches. I was coaching at a nearby travel league, and they asked me to come over and interview and see if I wanted to take over the job, which I eventually did. And in the interview, somewhere early on in the interview, when they asked me what would I do, what would be the first steps, you know, some question like that, my response to them puzzled them. And my response to what would be the first step or what's needed here in this program was, we need to be good at something. Perhaps it's power running, perhaps it's short passes, perhaps it's a stout defense. But we have to start by being good at something on the field. And I got puzzled looks, and you know, but don't you want, and they gave me all these grand schemes, and my answer was a polite version of, you're just not there yet. You're just unrealistic about your program, about your kids, about your talent, about everything but the really fancy uniforms that you have. You know, right now is not to the point where we can think about stuff. The only thing we can think about is, what can we do between now and the next season to get enough kids, to get enough qualified coaches, to make sure that when we hit the field, it looks like football, and there's at least something that we can do better than most teams, and something that most teams were going to keep up at night trying to defend us. And I think it was a hard sell, but ultimately they realized that they were not in a position to think about, you know, all the things that you hear at a lot of these clinics and high-level offenses and complex defenses and electronic systems and sideline replay and all that stuff. The first thing that a lot of these teams should do that are losing players or they're losing games is just be good at something.
And the way to do that is to really get deep on the fundamentals, and then within that play, learning what different scenarios the players are going to face. Because you're going to find, really, in any situation, you know, yes, people can run a lot of different defensive fronts or do a lot of things with movement, et cetera. But ultimately, your player at any position is going to face a limited amount of scenarios with that particular play. And I like to take it back to, you know, the stretch play we put in 2004, at a school I was a head coach at. We had not run the zone running game before. And I tell this story all the time. The coach I learned it from was a former Big Ten coordinator. And I asked him the question as we were learning, coach, what do you do if coach that player up if he can't do certain things? And his answer was, well, I just go to the next guy. And I thought, well, you know, you're at a program where you have the next guy. We're at a smaller place. I don't. Like, I got this guy, and I might have one other kid we'll be training to be the next guy, but he ain't going to be ready right away. So we, in a lot of ways, you know, watch film, kind of had to reverse engineer it. We certainly learned more after year one, but broke it down to, here's basically the four things that can happen on this play. And then we created drills that simulated that. And our drills, every drill we ran on that field, every position, was 100% related to what was going to happen in the game. And I see like these drill books go out with like 400 drills for your program, and you know, these drill videos, and guys see something on Twitter, on YouTube, oh, I'm going to use that in practice today. And ultimately, to me, the question is, why? Why are you including that in your practice? What does that do for that exact scheme that you're using to make your player better? And I don't think a lot of guys can answer those. We're in, as much as these kids are instant and on demand, we get into kind of a copy and paste mentality as coaches, and we think because this team with, you know, that logo on their helmet, they're winning a lot of games and they're doing it, so it has to be good. We have to think about how those things directly apply to our kids and the situation they're in. And if we can teach them all those scenarios and teach them all the things that are going to happen on that particular play, we have a good start there. Now, we're going to have to build. We're going to have a sequence. We're going to have some of those situations where we understand if this isn't working at the time because of this, then this is where we can go. But we can't have too many of those and expect to get good at anything.
Yeah, and I think the one word that underlies everything that you just said is time.
Mm-hmm.
And in one of my Nike Coach of the Year lectures, I spent most or all of an entire lecture on time management. And I opened my PowerPoint presentation. The first or second slide or somewhere early in the program was, as coaches, we are essentially in the time management business. Most leagues, most teams, from youth up through high school, have limitations. Especially now, not only do you have time limitations where you can't start practice until some week in August and you can only practice so many hours a day, now there's further limitations. You can only have so many minutes of full contact. And so we're all under the same time restrictions. What do you do with those time restrictions? And like you said, my opinion is if you're spending time doing monkey rolls and all kinds of drills that don't directly apply to what's on the field, then you're either coaching a team of superstars and you have 20 other qualified coaches, or you're wasting your time and you're wasting your kids' time, and you need to get down to those basics so that your kids are prepared for those two or three or four possible things that are going to happen in each play in each one of their positions. And I you know, that might be kind of the single biggest oversight that happens in a lot of these subpar programs, is they're just not good time managers. And what they do spend their time on is watching the TV games on Saturdays and Sundays and trying to emulate that, when the reality is that you know, their coaching staff and their players just don't have the ability to mimic what you see on an NFL game on Monday Night Football.
Well, that's exactly it. And I agree with you that the time management is a huge thing. I mean, from the very simplest things, I heard a very experienced NFL, former NFL player, on a rant about that, saying, you know, why do we do jumping jacks? When does that happen in the game? I thought, wow, you're right. You know, we do a lot of those things. I mean, it doesn't, things that honestly don't add a lot of value. They don't add a lot to a kid athletically from that perspective. But we get into, I guess, time-honored traditions that we're going to do things a certain way, or this is how I learned it, whatever. And I think we just need to reframe some of those things. Andy Ryland and I did a whole series of those, 15 of them. We're finishing up. Our last few will be aired. Probably by the time this is out, those will be aired on what we call deliberate practice. And just rethinking, you know, everything from, you know, what we call everyday drills to how we vary things throughout the season, through how we add more things to what we could build on from some very basic drills, and how those should progress in our teaching over the course of the year, and honestly, how we can save that time by being creative with how we look at, you know, practicing different things, that we can make some very efficient practices. And I would suggest, if you're looking, and I think a lot of this goes to, we got to give some aid as high school coaches, and, you know, even college coaches who have the ability to get out in their communities. A lot of college coaches, the majority of us are at the small college level. We see all those teams on TV, but there's, you know, I don't know how many, it's like 700 programs that are small college. We have that ability to get down there and help people out, that we got to show them how to practice. And, you know, I think probably I mentioned that coach in the SI article about, you know, he's running the same program. I'd be willing to bet that they're successful at that because he's also installed the way they practice, and I'd be willing to bet that they're very good at practice the way they do it. I don't know. I don't know that particular coach. But for me, if something's going to work like that, they probably can only do that because they practice it very well. And hey, kids can stretch. You can do some incredible things with them. They can learn. But it all starts with being very organized and being good at teaching those things you want. So you have to think about the outcomes. What do you want out of a certain thing? What does every kid on the field need to know? How is that play going to be successful? If you're out there thinking as a youth coach, you're going to out-scheme and fool everybody, you're not really – you know, you're kind of doing a disservice for the player because it's about their development, how they develop. And yes, winning is good. Everybody is happy when they're successful. But part of the positive experience is they see their learning and development growth as well.
Yeah. And I want to just back up a little bit to what you said about you know, learning how to practice. That was, you know, in this interview with this travel program. One of my other comments was, you know, you don't know how to practice. Your kids just don't know how to practice, and the coaches don't know how to practice. And again, you get the funny look, like, well, I don't know, I've seen them out there, and they're running around, they're throwing the football. But, you know, little things, hustling back to line, you know, for your kids in a line, and you throw them a ball, you know, having that kid that's not doing anything or he can't play, or a mom or a dad that's just watching, hey, stand behind the kids so if they drop a pass, you know, the kids aren't running after it, and we always have two footballs and, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. And I don't know that there's I guess it's simple when you've seen it done before, and, maybe it seems like everybody knows it, but I don't know that everybody does know it. And like you described with the 25 kids in line and eight coaches watching the kid in the front of the line, you know, those are simple things, and like I mentioned earlier, they're achievable, they're attainable. There's no barrier to do it. It's just up to us to do it. I know what a lot of the answers are on the field and on the practice field, but I think, Keith, what the hard part is a lot of the people that will be listening to this podcast, you know, maybe we're preaching to the choir a little bit, the coaches and administrators and assistants and parents that take the time to listen and educate themselves are probably on the better half of programs out there. What I have yet to kind of figure out is how do you reach the fairly large number of coaches and administrators in these programs that are losing kids? How do you get the message to them? How do you communicate what should be kind of common sense and easy to implement things? How do you get that message out there?
Well, I think that is the challenge and the tough part. I know some of the things we're doing at USA Football go a long way in helping coaches in that manner. I would suggest that a good baseline for everybody to start with is to get your youth coaches signed up and certified in Heads Up Football. I can tell you from the perspective of where that started as a lot of health and safety, we continuously add to that every single season. And I know in our next offering, we are going to talk about practice. We are going to talk about fundamentals of coaching. We're going to get into blocking and tackling that is the safest out there in technique because it removes the head from contact. And, you know, we got to be focused on those things. So I would say that's a great start for everybody. Make sure your youth coaches are going through that program. On top of that, spend time yourself. Help them get organized. Provide them tools. Maybe it's a practice planner. Maybe it's going through and giving them access to things you could put together on Huddle. I think in a lot of ways, we can treat our upcoming youth coaches like we do players and give them the install for what they're going to do in practice. Don't just say, hey, here's our playbook. Here's how we teach some things. Here's a two-hour time together with us to ask some questions and, okay, now go. Constantly support them. I think if that's all we do, I know I used to do it. The only thing we had, we'd have a coach's clinic. I'd give them a video that goes along with it. I did want to provide them more. But, you know, now when I'm thinking about the technology we have, there's all kinds of things we could do. We don't even necessarily have to get the group together. I mean, we could hold a webinar and record it and send it out to all of them. We can interact in some kind of private Facebook group or community where we are providing that support for our coaches. So I would encourage everybody just to rethink how you're organizing, rethink how you get your information out there. Coach up your coaches. If the program matters to you, you're going to put your time in there. But again, I don't think it has to be that you're always somewhere with guys working. Again, think about how you could streamline that for yourself. You could put all those essentially teach tapes, and we use that old term, teach tapes. There's no tape anymore, but we still say that. But the teach tapes together for those coaches, for that level. Take into consideration players they have, their experience, the things they're going to need to do. Show them how to run drills. Show them how to install plays. Show them how to troubleshoot maybe particular things that they're going to have to face maybe over the course of the season. If you could provide that support for coaches, I think you really start to move the game ahead, because now you're making those guys better. You're supporting them. You're teaching them. And ultimately, your program's going to thrive because you've done the work at the lower levels.
And that's a great point. And I think the technology today offers coaches that are willing to take advantage of it, offers coaches a great advantage. Take some film of a game, telestrate a few plays on a system like Huddle, you know, blast that out to his kids. The kids can look at it on their own time with his notes, with his comments, with his telestration. And then when they get to the field, they're already a few steps ahead. You don't have to review that with them on the field. They've seen it. They've heard it. So you're at least a little ways down the line when you get to the field, and you can kind of get right to it a little faster. And the technology today is amazing. I can imagine that would be like a million years ago when, when I was playing, and how much of a difference that would have made. And instead of trying to, the coach takes out his big book with a lot of handwritten notes on it and tries to show it to the whole group of 25 kids on an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper. Boy, what a difference. It's just got to be utilized by the coaches, and it was a tremendous advantage today.
Coach, I think when we look at this too, and we're talking about using technology to install what we're doing, earlier we mentioned, you know, we have to be realistic about what we're asking our kids to do. I think what's interesting, talk to on this podcast a lot of state championship coaches, and you know, usually some of the first to be on the podcast will be the guys in Alaska. And one of those coaches runs the Full House Tee. He's won 116 games with that. He's 116-6, 10 state championships, 7 in a row, and it's the Full House Tee. I mean, when you think about it, yes, it's kind of archaic, but then I watched them run it. And you talk about some of the precision that went into it. You talk about some of the team play. Like, one of the things he focuses on in grades is their ability to fake. And I'm not kidding. I mean, there's some clips I saw. The back comes out, let's say, on the right side. They're double tight, full house tee. Back comes out on some kind of an off-tackle play on the right. Ends up sliding towards the sideline. Is running down the sideline on the right. And there's a kid carrying out his fake all the way on the other side of the field, running down like he has the football at well. And most of the time, at least for a little bit, he dragged the player with him and took him away from the play. But that kid, and the way they coach it, he goes all the way to the end zone or until he hears the whistle like that. And I thought, when I'm looking at the details that went into it, yes, it's a simple system, but it works well with his particular kids, and they had success. And I would say those kids running, you know, again, it's not as flashy, it's not what you see on TV, but those kids running that full house tee at the high school level and winning and being successful on the field had a heck of a lot more fun than that team I mentioned who were running, you know, five wide and couldn't move the football down the field.
Exactly. I think if you were to poll a lot of your successful coaches, you know, if you looked at the coaches who win not just this year but year after year after year, I'll bet you'll find that the successful coaches have far fewer plays in their playbook than the teams that don't do well. You know, they're perennially at the bottom of the league. In my system, in the double gun system, it kind of starts with a, you know, double wing philosophy, and I have a whole chapter on faking. And one of our little reward systems that would have watching film was we would count how many times we could fake out the camera guy filming our game, and and he'd follow the faking player instead of the player with the ball, and the kids earned some points for that and eventually a pizza or fun stuff like that. But it's like bunting in baseball. It's sometimes a lost art, these little things, faking. The main part about that, Keith, is those are achievable things What I talk about in my double gun system is it's a system that's based on things that any kid can do. You don't need a ton of talent. You don't need to be 6'2 and 185 pounds and run a 4'6 to be a good faker. And I think coaches that understand that and implement kids or implement systems that not just can be run by this year's talent, but can be run by next year and next year and next year. And I think a lot of coaches don't appreciate that. You need to run a system that's correct for your entire program. You know, not for the stud senior that you have this year or not for the stud quarterback that you're building for next year. You need to run something that's of the appropriate complexity level that can be handled successfully by the coaches that you have this year, by the players you have this year, by the players you have next year, by the coaches you have next year. And that way you're not learning all new systems every year. Third year junior, your fourth year senior aren't in their second or third system, learning their second or third set of blocking rules, you know, by the time they graduate from your school.
And it's a whole different topic. And I actually had a coach, he's a GA at the college level. And he asked me the other day, can you teach me how you go from a collection of plays to a system? And, you know, I think, you know, that's a topic for another conversation. But I believe this in general, coach, is that you can progress to some different things and kind of have your offense or your defense work on a continuum of skill sets that from year to year, you're building on fundamentals, and you might have different pieces. You can work the personnel differently, but not go back to, we're scrapping this, we're going to something else. If you set your system up right, if you use some good terminology, you think ahead of as you're putting it together, you know, what if we want to do this someday? How would we do it? You might not use it then, but that exercise kind of starts to give you the answer on how our terminology should work. And if you set it up well, you might start as let's say a Full House T team, and years down the line, somehow you might have progressed to running RPOs. You know, it doesn't matter, but you can progress to that without having to change that. Because every time you change, I always say it, when you change a system, everybody in your program becomes a freshman again.
Exactly. And again, the same way that if you polled all the successful coaches that have probably fewer plays in their playbook, they would probably also have fewer formations and a consistent theme, a consistent personality year. I'm just thinking of some of the teams here in the various levels of high school football, that are in the playoffs every year and win championships on a regular basis. If you name me one of those towns, I can almost tell you exactly what their offense and defensive system is, and it's very similar year to year to year. They're not picking out the flavor of the month just because they have a slightly different set of kids. It's very consistent, and that way you can build from freshman year to senior year. And in my double gun system, you change by the type of plays you call. You're not changing your system. The blocking rules remain the same. The backfield rules, the motion rules, all the play terminology and the play calling remains the same. But you can make it a passing offense, a running offense, based on how the coach implements the system. But to the kids, it's all very much the same thing. You're not relearning things from year to year. And I think a lot of programs would benefit from something that's versatile like that, yet simple enough so you can be successful with it without having a huge number of kids and a huge number of coaches.
Jay, I appreciate you taking the time, the article you put together, and sharing some ideas here today on how we can help this game. Final thoughts, I guess, for our listeners as we tie things up.
Yeah, I think it's a positive message overall in that I think there's a lot that we can do that we have within our control to get players, keep players, have them interested, offer fun and exciting programs. I think first and foremost, it starts with gathering a group of dedicated coaches. Coach up your coaches. Every coach should hit the field teaching those same things, all with the same philosophy, so that the kids are hearing one message. So if you're having issues with your program, I would start by finding a coach who could then organize and get other coaches up to speed for your program. And second is just to be realistic. Be realistic about what your program can offer. Have programs and systems in place that can benefit. You know, they're not too aggressive. You're not giving your kids too much to do. Be realistic about your program. Improve it year to year. And I think a lot of people will be amazed at how much fun the kids have, how much they talk amongst each other. And once you can offer a fun and exciting program, the rest of the stuff will take care of itself.
Coach, again, thank you. I appreciate your time. For our listeners out there, if you would please, just very quick, share your contact information where they could get in touch with you if they have any questions or would like some follow-up.
Sure. My email address is coach@doublegunoffense.com. You can go to doublegunoffense.com to take a look at some of the details. I'm here in Connecticut, East Coast time, and chatting with other coaches about things. I love to do the theoretical stuff, and in the system there's detailed stuff for everything from a youth program all the way up to high school options.
Coach, thanks again, and forward to talking more ball with you in the future.
Thank you, Keith.
Thanks for listening to USA Football's Coach and Coordinator Podcast. For more resources, visit the Coach Performance Center at usafootball.com.